different than what we've done so far, although I hope you'll find it of value. It is something that I've had a great passion for over the years. It's one of those things where you spend a lot of time developing and a lot of time working on, and then the years will go by and you don't spend a lot of time on, but it's still a passion and something that you enjoy very much. I have to begin by putting context to this presentation. In 1979, my family and I moved to Massachusetts. Now, having grown up in the southern part of the United States and served in Atlanta, Georgia for the first part of my ministry, it was a bit different moving up to the Northeast, but it turned out to be a wonderful experience. I always remember telling my grandmother from Arkansas that we were moving to Massachusetts, and she said, "Well, where on earth is that?" And then she said, true story, she said, "Is that a communist country?" And, of course, after I lived there, I thought she might have been closer to right than she knew. But we enjoyed immensely living in Massachusetts, and certainly the historical aspects of that part of the country are unique to our country. And certainly, obviously, the colonial period and all the things that went on there. In 1981, I received a phone call from Pasadena asking if I would participate in a project. They were putting together a feast film, if you remember the feast films from back in those days. There would often be a theme. It would certainly be news of the work and what was going on in the church, but there would be a theme. And it was a period of time where we ran themes on the history of the church. If you remember the writer passing the baton and going through the various stages of the church. And they said, we really want to focus on the story of the Sabbatarians in New England. And they said, here is a list of things that we would like for you to find for us, because we'd like to get them on film. And at that time, the extent of my knowledge of the history of the Sabbatarians in New England went back to church history at Ambassador College. And in church history at Ambassador College, we had studied about Stephen Mumford, how he came over from England and was established the first Sabbath-keeping church in America back in 1671 out of Newport, Rhode Island. I had heard and actually had seen pictures in books of a meeting place for Sabbatarians in Newport, Rhode Island. That's about all I knew. And I was asked to do several things. They said, "Well, do you think you can find the grave of Stephen Mumford?" Now, Stephen Mumford came over in 1671, died in the early 1700s. And they said, "Do you think you can find his grave?" And I said, "Well, I have no clue. We'll see if I can." And he said, "And we'd also like for you to see if you could find where he may have lived. We also want pictures and video of the meeting hall, the Sabbatarian meeting hall, and anything else that you can find on the original members at that particular period of time." And so I began my odyssey in the spring and summer of 1981. And that odyssey took me over the next 5 years in gathering and collecting material. It was a unique period of time because all of the material of that time was open to me. You cannot go back today and get access to most of the material that I will show you this morning. It is either gone, it is either locked up somewhere, but you cannot get access to that material. Also, I happened upon a lady in the Newport Historical Society that proved to be invaluable. Her name was Mrs. Bullhouse. Mrs. Bullhouse stood about 4'8" and knew everything there was to know about the historical archives of the city of Newport. And she befriended me, and I spent many hours sitting in an office at the Newport Historical Society talking to Mrs. Bullhouse. She located things for me that were hidden in places that no one even knew. She even helped me discover the will of Stephen Mumford, which existed in an old file that had been put aside in the Newport Historical Society. So it was through her that I also discovered things that are not available today. She was about 80 years of age at that time, and I'm not absolutely certain, but it would be my guess 20 years later, she's probably not still working at the Newport Historical Society. In fact, I would be my guess, obviously, that she's no longer alive. So there was a unique period of time. There was a unique challenge of finding the information that drove me or guided me in putting this material together. I've made these presentations at Ambassador College back in the late 80s and early 90s. Various church areas have asked to see the material. I've shown it there, and I show it each year at the Ambassador Bible Center. Several other organizations have asked to use the material, and I've been very happy to loan it to them. There have been several that have done television programs using the slides that I have in my own personal possession. So this is the story, or that's the background to the story that I will tell you today. It is a story of Sabbath keepers. I am always very careful not to proclaim that all of these people were a part of the Church of God. I do not believe that every Sabbath keeper is a member of the true church. Look around you today. Seventh-day Adventists are essentially a Protestant denomination that happens to keep the Sabbath. They believe in the Trinity. They believe in a lot of other things that we would not accept. The Scriptures tell us that the Sabbath is a sign of God's people. It's certainly not the only sign. But because of the historical difficulties of locating or determining exactly what many of these people believed, my comment has always been, I believe the true Church of God was among these people during this period of time, but I would not declare that all of these people were part of the true Church of God. This group of people later declared themselves to be Seventh-day Baptists, and there's still a Seventh-day Baptist group today. They're a very small group, scattered around the country, but there are Seventh-day Baptists today. It is true, though, historically, that originally they had no such name. You'll find a lot of revisionist history goes on with these people. In other words, historians will say, well, those were Seventh-day Baptists. Well, the fact of the matter is they did not adopt the name Seventh-day Baptist until late 1700s or early 1800s. Originally, they chose not to have an official name, but in their documents, they call themselves the Church or the Church of God or occasionally the Church of Christ. But their idea was that if they adopted an official name, that would mean they were a part of the society of their day, and they chose not to, and they had the internal references to the Church and the Church of God. Yet historians will tell you the story of Stephen Mumford as the first of the Seventh-day Baptists to arrive in America, which is simply not true. He was a part of a church from Bell Lane in London who came over to America in 1664 and chose to live in Newport, Rhode Island, and from there the first church of Sabbath keepers in America was founded. It began with seven members in Newport, Rhode Island. This story covers a period of time, as you will see, from about the early 1600s up until the 1700s. So it's a very narrow portion of history, but it's probably, as at least to me, one of the most interesting periods of time, even in regards to church history. Where is the church in the 1600s? Where is the church as we get into the early 1700s? And that's the story we're going to cover this morning, and I hope you'll find it enlightening. I have about somewhere near 500 slides. I will show you about 60 of them today. So this is a very small portion of what I've collected on this particular topic. And again, I hope you will find it interesting. There is nothing of, theological significance here, with the exception of identifying these people as a part of the thread of the Church of God during this period of time. So let's begin, though, with a scripture, Matthew 16, verse 18. This is an important scripture for anyone who wants to study church history. If this scripture is true, and remember what we said yesterday, then the Church of God, God's people, will always exist from the time of Christ until our day. The challenge isn't whether the church existed at this period of time. The challenge is where was the church during this period of time. So look at Matthew 16, verse 18. Christ said, I will build my church, and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it. I will build my church, and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it. Now, consider this statement. Who is building the church? Well, we know that Christ is the one who builds the church. Why is there a church? This is the first mention, at least in the English versions, of the word church in the New Testament. And, of course, we know the church officially begins on the day of Pentecost. But Christ said, I will build my church. I've thought about this a lot over the years because we've We've seen individuals who were so disillusioned after some of the events of the 1990s that they will make the statement, I will never again be a part of an organized body or an organized church. An organized religion is somehow evil or bad. And I kind of thought that through, and if you consider it to its ultimate, then what does that say about God and what God does? Would God do anything that would be unorganized? Would God do anything that would be really just kind of all over the place? What is God doing? I think we also have to accept the fact that God works through, or God has established, the church. I did not choose the church. I did not choose this methodology or this method to bring people into His family. There is some reason that God chose to have a church. He could have had just individuals with no church, no body. He could have done that. I think if we consider, if there's a blank slate and God wants to build a family, and we believe that's what God wants, He wants a family. I don't think any of us today would say that, well, God is limited and has to do it a certain way. But God chose to do it a certain way. There is something significant about the church as a part of God's plan. And I think we must not forget that. And while the church is, because it's composed of human beings, has always been flawed, to the idea of people coming together, worshiping together, being a part of a body, which is what the church is, a group of individuals called out, ecclesia, who form a congregation or congregations. This is the method God chose to bring people into His family. I didn't choose it. I didn't build the church. You didn't build the church. I am thrilled, though, to be a part of it. And I believe we all are part of that body. The word hell, of course, we understand, comes from the Greek word Hades. And it's significant from the point of view that, what is Christ saying here? He says, death will never stop the church. The church will never die. Now, if this verse is true, then from the time of Acts chapter 2, which would be 31 A.D., until our very day today, 2007, the church has never ceased. The challenge for us as the body of Christ today is to locate those people. And there has been a concerted effort historically, I think driven by Satan himself, to destroy any record and any information about the church, especially during the Middle Ages. Now, we're going to be beyond the Middle Ages today, but when you stop and think about it, there are no firsthand writings of the Sabbath keepers during the Middle Ages, because toward the end of the Middle Ages, all of their writings were destroyed. We have no firsthand writings of the Waldensians. We have no firsthand writings of any of the groups that we would or could identify as being a part of the church during the Middle Ages. They were all destroyed. We have to read the writings of their enemies to find out anything about them. And again, I don't think it's just accidental that all of this was destroyed. I think there's been a concerted effort to hide the story of the Church of God. And even sometimes beyond the Middle Ages, you'll see some of that. So we begin with this idea in mind. There's another verse that we need to go to as well. Look at Hebrews 4, verse 9. Hebrews 4, verse 9 gives us another pointer or marker in locating the people of God. This is in the King James Version. It says, there remaineth therefore a rest to the people of God. American Standard Version says, there remaineth therefore a Sabbath rest for the people of God. And the Bible in Basic English says, so that there is still a Sabbath keeping for the people of God. Now, this verse becomes rather significant. It identifies something that you and I think we all recognize and know, that the people of God will be keeping the Sabbath. They have from that time all the way through. They continue to this very day. It says, there remains, therefore, a Sabbath rest for the people of God. Or in the Bible in Basic English, there is still a Sabbath keeping for the people of God. There is still a Sabbath keeping for the people of God. And if you understand a bit more about this word rest in Hebrews 4, verse 9, you find out even more. This is the only place in the New Testament where this Greek word sabbatismos is used. It is an unmistakable reference to the Sabbath. There are those that try to reckon it to the millennium, or to a future rest. Certainly that's found in Hebrews 4. But this particular verse, the term rest, comes from sabbatismos. And sabbatismos means Sabbath rest or keeping of the Sabbath. It is unmistakable, it is indisputable that this identifies the people of God as being Sabbath keepers. Sabbath keepers. So we know the church will always exist. We know the church will be Sabbath keepers. And now the challenge is to find those people. We're going to begin our story all the way back to the end of the Middle Ages. The end of the Middle Ages we have identified in Europe, primarily in the area of southern France, in an area called Lyon. We have identified Sabbath keepers as early as 1100 A.D. They go by various names. One of the more common names are the Waldensians or the Waldenses. Waldenses is also a reference that you will see about these people. No one is absolutely certain where they got their name from. Some will say that their name comes from Peter Waldo. Others would dispute that and say that their name comes from the area where they were, which around Lyon in southern France is an area where we have the Valdez or Valdez Mountains in the Valdez Valley, just there in the Alps portion, the northern Alps it would be, northern portion of the Alps just in the area of Lyon. So therefore they extrapolate from Valdez, the Waldensians, or the Waldenses, or the Waldenses, or Waldensians. I don't know that anyone is absolutely certain what the true origin is, but the group were called Waldenses, or Waldensians, and they occupied the valley regions of the Alps in the 1100s until about 1500. In the latter part of the 1400s, we have the Spanish Inquisition, in which the Catholic Church controlled armies, in which those armies were sent into the valleys of the Alps and given the command to destroy all the heretics. This was known as an area of many heretics. They were a fairly large group of people. They kept the Feast of Tabernacles, that at least that has been identified. And also other things that they did. They believed in the millennium on this earth. They believed in, of course, preaching the gospel of, at their time and their day. These are a few of the things we can pick up from their enemies, since all of their writings were destroyed in the 1400s during the Spanish Inquisition. There are no firsthand writings from the Waldensians. We have none. One of the best books, and I'll show you a little bit later, one of the great finds that came as a result of this study is a book called The Heresiography. Heresiography is a five-volume work that was put together by the Catholic Church in the latter part of the 1400s and 1500s. It was quoted in the old booklet put out by the Worldwide Church of God or the Radio Church of God at that time called The True History of the True Church. Later on, there were scholars within the church who said that book is a fraud. It does not exist. You are quoting, and this often happens in history, and this is one of the great problems you will find historically. You will find things repeated from one historian to another historian, only to discover they're simply quoting each other, and none of them are quoting an original source. So a historian makes a statement, quotes some source or reference that he's seen, maybe he hasn't seen, and then other historians just quote him because they can't locate the original source. So if the original quote is in error, then all of these historians just simply propagate the error. So that we were accused, and this would have been sometime in the late 70s, of propagating an error because there is no such book as Heresiography. We quoted the Heresiography in the old booklet from, I think, 1953, The True History of the True Church, because it stated that the Waldensians were Sabbath keepers. Now, those in at that particular time, and there were some in the church, said, well, that's not true. The Waldensians were always Sunday keepers. There is a group of people today who call themselves Waldensians, and they are Sunday keepers. The truth of the matter is that the Waldensians, there were two segments of the Waldensians. One group kept the Sabbath, and one group were Sunday keepers. There's a book written by a man named Muston, M-U-S-T-O-N. The title of his book is Israel of the Alps, and he gives the whole story of the Waldensians and tells that they were so close to the Israelites of old that he called them the Israel of the Alps. And it's a very interesting historical book. But the claim that the heresiography did not exist intrigued me back when I was doing some research in the 1980s. So I went to the oldest public library in America, called the Redwood Library, located in Newport, Rhode Island. It's the oldest public library in the United States. And I went through their records. And I discovered there an original copy of the heresiography. It isn't one book. It is a five-volume work. And it does exist. And it does go through all of the heresies during the Middle Ages that the Catholic Church identified as heresies, and has considerable information on the Waldensians. And that's where we glean some of the information that we have today about these people. So we have seen an original source. The book does exist. As I said, it's a five-volume work, and it does identify the Waldensians as Sabbath keepers. Now, that's, again, this is where they were. But now what happens? Well, we see that sometime in the latter part of the 1400s, after the Spanish Inquisition, after the armies from the Catholic Church have routed and killed and martyred so many of the Sabbath keepers in southern France, they disappear from southern France. Somehow, we don't know how, they show up in Britain in the early to mid-1500s. Now, again, you can see your geography. It's not all that difficult to imagine them getting over to Britain. But somehow, these Sabbath keepers go from southern France to Britain. Essentially, though, the Waldensians are destroyed in southern France, and none of the Sabbath keepers exist anymore in that particular area that I'm aware of. There may be some, but I'm just simply not aware of them. There is a paper that was published it's been published for well over 150 years. Began about 1850, 1840. I think the first edition was 1848, called The Sabbath Recorder. It was put out by Church of God people. This is the Sabbath Recorder from June the 11th, 1868. And it's an article about Sabbath keepers. And here's what it says. In 1552, many in England were known as Sabbatarians. Many in England were known as Sabbatarians in 1552. Now, the article offers no real evidence of that. It simply makes the statement. We believe that's a true statement, because by 1595, we find in England a rather quite an uproar over the Sabbath in 1595. The first book published about the Sabbath was an attack on the Sabbath in 1595, written by an author named Nicholas Bound. Nicholas Bound wrote a book attacking Sabbath keepers in 1595. Now, logic would tell you that you don't write a book attacking something if it doesn't exist. Obviously, there were Sabbath keepers in England by 1595. This article states that they were there from 1552. Now, you put the dates together, the Spanish Inquisition in the 15th century. You have the attacks upon the Sabbath keepers in southern France. It makes a lot of sense that shortly thereafter, you will find Sabbath keepers in England, and no doubt having a connection to the Sabbath keepers in the Alpine region of southern France. We have no historical connection to make. They disappear in one place, and they appear in another. They disappear in southern France, latter part of the 1400s, early 1500s, and they appear in England somewhere around 1552, but somewhere around 1530 to 1550, Sabbath keepers show up in England. Now, you have to understand a bit about the history of England and what's going on when they go from Catholic to Protestant, back to Catholic, back to Protestant. You can understand there would be some problems during some of that period of time with being a Sabbath keeper in England. We do know this, that by the end of by the early 1600s, we have identified 11 Sabbath-keeping churches in the London area. 11 Sabbath-keeping churches in the London area by the early 1600s. Oops, I didn't want to go that fast. So we know that they're here by the 1600s. We know that they've disappeared from southern France. So while we don't have a direct link between the two, we have certainly, at the very worst, it's a historical coincidence that they disappear in one area and then appear in another area. We do have some information about these 11 Sabbath-keeping churches around London. We have some documented evidence that at least one of them kept the spring holy days. We don't really know about the others, but we do have some evidence that one of them kept the spring holy days. We're going to find that Stephen Mumford was a member of one of these churches in the Bell Lane area of London, which is somewhere in the northern area of London. So now we have 11 Sabbath-keeping churches by the early 1600s. Nicholas Bound has written his book, which was published against the Sabbath, stirred quite an upheaval in the area during that period of time. And then we have others who wrote books at that time it was almost like little booklets or little tracts that were written supporting the Sabbath. Theophilus Brayborn is one who wrote a book supporting the Sabbath. Theophilus Brayborn was arrested and thrown in prison, he and his wife, for observing the Sabbath and for writing about the Sabbath and passing it around London. He was arrested and actually recanted the Sabbath, unfortunately, about 1624. After spending 15 years in prison, he recanted. He was released, but his wife remained faithful, refused to recant the Sabbath, and died in prison about 1629. One thing that I found rather remarkable is that some of the strongest individuals among the Sabbath keepers were the ladies, the wives, and the daughters during this period of time, and their faithfulness when they were challenged regarding the Sabbath. But she died in prison. He was released having recanted the Sabbath. So it's, again, an interesting story. But as all of this is happening in England, so we now find, because England goes from Catholic, you know, during the time of Henry, from Catholic to Protestant, back to Catholic for a short period of time, and then finally to Protestant, which allowed for these Sabbath keepers to survive during this period of time. Had Catholicism dominated England beyond the period of the late 1500s, then we would have seen probably a different story about the Sabbath keepers. But it seems as though when one area is closed, that another area opens up. And coincidentally, England, as I said, goes from Catholic to Protestant, which allowed for a difference of opinion that would not have existed under Catholicism. And so that's an interesting part of the story. But as this is going on here, it also appears that God is preparing a place when the door is going to close here where the Sabbath keepers can also go. And so now you take a step to the side and identify something else that's going on at this period of time that is unrelated to the Sabbath, but is going to play a significant role. This is a statue of Roger Williams. Roger Williams was born in Britain in 1603 and died in New England in 1683. Roger Williams was not himself, as far as we know, a Sabbath keeper. Some have proclaimed that. If you've ever seen the old book by Duggar and Dodd on the history of the church, you have to be very careful. You will find that Duggar and Dodd proclaimed everyone who was a friend or who had any contact with a Sabbath keeper has proclaimed them to be Sabbath keepers, and there's no historical evidence to prove that. There's no historical evidence to prove that Roger Williams was ever a Sabbath keeper. He is known as the founder of the Rhode Island colony, and he was also the founder of the Baptist Church in America, the First Baptist Church in America. Roger Williams himself was a rather strange person. He was driven out of every church he ever pastored. He came to America, arrived in Boston in 1630 seeking religious freedom, and he pastored a church. He founded a church in Salem, Massachusetts, and was the pastor for about 6 months until they literally ran him out of town. The historical writings do not give a clear indication as to why. We do have a rather good collection of Roger Williams' letters at Roger Williams College, which is located south of Providence, Rhode Island. They have all of his original letters there. He was a good friend of a Sabbath keeper, and he wrote a number of letters about the Sabbath and even about the holy days. I have a copy of one letter that he wrote in which he told his friend that he could not accept the holy days because of Colossians 2, verse 16. Which also tells me that some of these Sabbath keepers either entertained the holy days or were keeping the holy days. This was from Samuel Hubbard, who was a Sabbath keeper living in the Rhode Island area and a good friend of Roger Williams. Many of his friends were Sabbath keepers, but there's no evidence that he ever was. But he secured a charter for the colony of Rhode Island in 1636. The first charter was given in 1636. A second charter was issued in 1660. Now, what's significant about this charter? Because of Roger Williams' experience, he was driven from England to the New World. He landed in Massachusetts. He started a church in Salem. He was driven out of Salem. He went down to Plymouth, Massachusetts. He was driven out of Plymouth after about 6 months there. He crossed the river from Massachusetts into an area that was unclaimed, and he claimed and sought a charter for the colony of Rhode Island. Essentially, he said, I can't get along with anyone else. I'm going to start a colony of my own. But he said, there's one thing I will do in my colony. I will guarantee religious freedom. You may think that the New World guaranteed religious freedom. That is not true. If you were not a part of the established group, the Puritans in Massachusetts, then you suffered greatly. There was no religious freedom in the colonies of America back in the early portion, except Rhode Island. The tiniest colony was the first one to not only proclaim religious freedom, but they guaranteed religious freedom. This is in the Rhode Island State House, a beautiful state capitol. It's the only state capitol in the United States that's entirely made of marble. Beautiful state capitol. Inside the state capitol, they have the royal charter that was issued by Charles II in 1660. Now, this is the second charter for Rhode Island obtained by Roger Williams. Again, it was written by, it was issued by the king and gave Roger Williams the ownership in that sense of Rhode Island, or established Rhode Island as a colony. Now, here is an excerpt from the charter. That's obviously been typed out. This is what it said. Now know ye that we, being willing to encourage the hopeful undertakings and to secure them in the free exercise and enjoyment of all the civil and religious rights appertaining to them, no person shall hereafter be molested, punished, disquieted, or called in question for any difference in opinion in matters of religion who do not disturb the civil peace. And you can see in Roger Williams' background and what he had been through, he wrote into the charter that you would be guaranteed freedom of religion. This is the only place in the New World where this was guaranteed, and it was an actual fact. Massachusetts Bay Colony did not do that, nor did any of the other original colonies. Only here can you find religious freedom. Now, this is going to explain later on why the Sabbath keepers came to Rhode Island. You know, why not go to other places? Well, Rhode Island guaranteed them religious freedom. And this is going to make a big difference. Roger Williams wanted that in the charter and got that in the charter. This is in Providence, Rhode Island. This is Roger Williams' home. It sits in Roger Williams Park in the northern part of Providence, Rhode Island. I'm sure, it's obviously been updated to some degree, but this is the home that he lived in what at that time was called Providence Plantations. There are two portions. If you look at Rhode Island is truly an island, or truly has an island. The mainland portion is called Providence Plantations, and the island part is where Newport is located. You have to cross a bridge to get to Newport, Rhode Island. There are always two parts to Rhode Island. It was two distinct sections of the colony, and they compensated for that by alternating the governor. The governor would, for one term, be from Providence, and the second term would be, and then after that, the next term would be from Newport. And that's how they handled this very distinct division. And, of course, until the bridges were built, you had to go by boat from Providence Plantations over to Newport. Two very distinct areas. Roger Williams settled in Providence and established Providence Plantations, as it was called at that time, and this was his home. This is a picture of the First Baptist Church in Providence, Rhode Island. They proudly proclaim themselves to have been founded by Roger Williams. Obviously, this church wasn't built back in the 1600s, but it is the church. You know, this is the congregation that was established by Roger Williams in 1638. There is some dispute among Baptists as to who founded the First Baptist Church in America. Most say that it was Roger Williams. The dispute is between Roger Williams and John Clark. John Clark founded a Baptist church in Newport, Rhode Island, about the same time that Roger Williams did in Providence. But Roger Williams is given the credit. Now, what most Baptists do not tell you is that Roger Williams also, following his same pattern, got disenchanted with the Baptists, and he left them after 6 months as well. His tenure in a church was about 6 months. And from Salem to Plymouth to the Baptist church in Rhode Island, after that, Roger Williams gave up on religion and became what he called a seeker of the truth for the rest of his life, but was never again a part of any church congregation that we know of. Here's the statement in front of the church, founded by Roger Williams, A.D. 1638. So this is the church that he founded in 1638. Now, everywhere else, even in the New World, there was great persecution for anyone who was not of the Puritan approach, at least in New England, toward religion. As you know, the Puritans were those who were going to purify the Church of England when they came to the New World. There were the Puritans and the Separatists, those who wanted a separate entity. But they ruled the day in New England. And anyone else was severely persecuted. And that primarily meant the Quakers and the Baptists. The Quakers and the Baptists were severely persecuted. In fact, if you fly into Boston today, you fly into the city of Boston, you fly, the airport in Boston is located in the Boston Harbor. You actually have to take a tunnel underneath the harbor to get into downtown Boston. When you fly in, you will fly over a little piece of land called Noodles Island. And there's no structure there today, but there was only one structure located on Noodles Island, and it was a prison. And this is where the Quakers and the Baptists were put during these days. They were put in prison. It's recorded that they were often locked up. They were given no water and no food, and they were just left there to die. That was the punishment for being a Quaker or for being a Baptist if you lived in Massachusetts in the 1600s. There was no religious freedom. To this day, there is a marker. This marker is on, this is Boston Common, which is the oldest public park in America. This marker is there about a lady named Mary Dyer. Mary Dyer, Quaker, witness for religious freedom, hanged on Boston Common, 1660. And my life not availeth me in comparison to the liberty of the truth. So if you were a Baptist, if you were a Quaker in Massachusetts, you were subject to being imprisoned and or killed. And the same would go for a Sabbath keeper in Massachusetts during that period of time. Of course, there were no Sabbath keepers that we know of in the colonies until Stephen Mumford arrives in 1664. But the Quakers were there, and they were severely persecuted during that time. Now, we need to back up and now go back to England. So we see in the colonies, there is a small colony that has been established that truly allows for religious freedom. So now we have an open door here. What's going to happen back in England? When the door closed in south of France, England opened up. What's happening in England that's going to cause the Sabbath keepers now to go to the next open door, which will be in the area of Newport, Rhode Island, where they can practice their religion and keep the Sabbath. Well, in a lot of political upheaval was taking place back in England as we get to the mid-1600s. During this period of time, there was a political party called the Fifth Monarchist. The Fifth Monarchist. They were political as well as religious party in England. They proclaimed that the British Empire, or that there would be a replacement for the British Empire, which would be the Fifth World Monarchy. If you read Daniel 2, you'll find the four world ruling empires, and then there's a fifth one, the stone that comes and breaks and knocks the image down. Their interpretation of that was that the British Empire would become the Fifth Monarchy, but it was going to be under their rule. You know, this party was going to take over and make it a world-ruling, or actually even more than it was, world-ruling empire identified as the stone that comes and destroys the four previous empires. That was going to be the British Empire. And they became a rather raucous political party in the mid-1600s. So much so that the Sabbath keepers were dragged into this, not because they believed in the Fifth Monarchist's ideas. They also were not political, but guess what? They also believed that there was coming a fifth monarchy, that Christ would come to this earth. He was the stone. But because they believed the British Empire would be, their current empire would not continue, but that there would be another replacement, they believed, of course, in the kingdom of God coming to this earth. They were dragged into this political dispute. So wherever the Sabbath keepers were meeting, the British soldiers were sent to disrupt them and to actually actually imprison some of them. This is a narrative. This was written in the 1661, I believe. You'll see the date at the bottom. London printed in the year 1662, I guess. This is the account of the imprisonment of John James. This is a little tract that I discovered in the library at Brown University in Providence. They have this little tract, an original tract written about the execution of John James. A narrative of the apprehending, commitment, arraignment, condemnation, and execution of John James, who suffered I have trouble reading some of this. It was the 16th day of 1661 of November. What happened, the story is recorded, that in the middle of a Sabbath service, as John James was preaching, the soldiers rushed into the meeting hall, dragged him from the lectern, took him across the street, and tried him in 30 minutes and convicted him of being not heresy, because they didn't care about heresy so much. They convicted him of being an enemy of the British crown, and they sentenced him to be hanged. For 3 months or so, he was imprisoned. His wife was allowed to come visit him. She appealed to the king to no avail. Also, the king's physician, Edward Stennett, who was a Sabbath keeper, appealed to the king as well. But no one would alter what was done. And John James went to the gallows and was hanged. After he was hanged, his body was quartered. It was quartered by tying four horses, one to each of his legs and one to each of his arms, and sending them running in four different directions, ripping his body apart. His head was placed on a pole and put outside the church building to prevent anyone else from attending Sabbath services in this particular area. It is very possible that Stephen Mumford witnessed these events. And although he was not listed as a member of this congregation, the Bell Lane congregation was not far from here, and Stephen Mumford was also a good friend of Edward Stennett. So now you begin to see persecution becoming intense in England against the Sabbath keepers. They are accused of being seditious. They are accused of being enemies of the crown. And so wherever the Sabbath keepers are, they're being hunted down, and many are being put in prison or killed, even though one of the physicians for the king, Edward Stennett, was indeed a Sabbath keeper. It's quite a remarkable story as to what's happening in England, the political upheaval that's going on there in the mid-1600s and latter part of the 1600s. So there's no wonder that in 1664, Stephen Mumford is going to take his family and get on a ship and head for Newport, Rhode Island, where there is an open door for religious freedom. So in 1664, Stephen Mumford and his wife Anne and their two children, Stephen and Anne, board a ship and arrive in Newport, Rhode Island, 1664. Having witnessed a lot of the persecution that took place against the Sabbath keepers during that period of time, during the time he was there in the London area. Newport, Rhode Island, as you see, sits on, as I said, an island off the coast of the mainland of the United States. You see Connecticut, Massachusetts, and Rhode Island stuck there in between, and Newport out on the island. You can see Cape Cod. You can see the whole area there. And again, this is where Newport is located, Newport, Rhode Island. Newport, upon Stephen Mumford's arrival in 1664, was a peaceful village of less than 1,000 people. Peaceful village of less than 1,000 people in 1664. Here's a picture of Newport Harbor. It's one of the prettiest harbors, one of the prettiest areas that you would ever want to visit. Just a beautiful location. Newport would be one of my favorite cities in all of the world. It's not a very big city. but it's just a very, very beautiful area. Reconstructed in the downtown area to reflect the colonial time. Downtown area is filled with old homes and old shops, just like it would have been in the 1700s. In fact, many of the buildings were constructed in the 1700s in the downtown area, just off the harbor in Newport, Rhode Island. This would have been the scene that, Stephen Mumford would have seen. I don't think the boats would have been there, and I'm sure the bridge wasn't there at that time. But other than that, this is the harbor that Stephen Mumford sailed into. Here's another picture of the harbor. Again, just coming in from the ocean into Newport, Rhode Island. When Stephen Mumford arrived in Newport, or actually shortly thereafter, you're going to find that there were a lot of places that existed that he no doubt visited. This is the oldest tavern in the United States, 1673, the White Horse Tavern. This is within two blocks of where Stephen Mumford lived. And there's no question in our minds that Stephen Mumford obviously visited this particular tavern during that period of time. It's also located just down the street from the cemetery where Stephen Mumford is buried. So this would have been in existence during this period of time as well. This is a picture of what the tavern looks like today. Again, 1673, an interesting place to visit, interesting place to have lunch if you ever happen to be in Newport, Rhode Island. A lot of other things existed during this period of time. This is the Redwood Library. This is where we found a copy of the Heresiography. This is the oldest public library in America. They have I think that's a statue of George Washington in front that was built later. It's been added on to, the front part was added to reflect a little bit of a different architecture, but the back portion is the library portion, and it's the oldest public library dating back to the 1600s in the United States. It's still operating. And you can go there and check books out and find all sorts of information in the Redwood Library. This is Newport, basically today. Would not have been a lot different during the time of Stephen Mumford when he arrived. These are the narrow streets. All of these houses along here were built in the 1700s or late 1600s. Most of them will have plaques you'll see on the side of the wall here that tell you the date it was built. See the one here, and then you see the one over here. It'll tell you the date these homes were built. This is what it's like to walk up and down the streets of Newport in the center of the town today. And again, it would have been very similar, except probably cobblestone streets or brick, as opposed to, of course, the asphalt that you see there today or the concrete that you see today. The Quakers, you might imagine, also being persecuted, as we saw in Massachusetts, came to Rhode Island in large numbers as well. In fact, the oldest Quaker meeting house in America is this one, which was built in 1699. So we find the Quakers and the Baptists flocking to Rhode Island for security, to be able to practice their religion. And Rhode Island was true to its word and did not bother any of these individuals. So Stephen Mumford arrives in 1664. There are two churches in town when he arrives. Now, contrary to what some historians state, there is no record of Stephen Mumford ever being ordained to the ministry. He was a church member. We find that one of the Stinnetts was his pastor back at Bell Lane, but Stephen Mumford was never ordained to the ministry. Some historical books will call him a minister, but he never was a minister. So where would he go to church? It's he, his wife, Anne, and their two children, and their Sabbath keepers. Some have been a bit dismayed by the fact that Stephen Mumford chose to fellowship with the Baptist Church in Rhode Island. The Baptist Church in Newport, which was established also, you'll see, in 1638. This is the plaque today, the United Baptist Church, that's there, that's in Newport today, and you'll see it's established in 1638. If you remember the date back when the First Baptist Church in Providence also has the date 1638. This is the dispute. Did Roger Williams start the Baptist Church in America first, or was it John Clark in Newport who started the First Baptist Church? Most historians say it was Roger Williams, but both started Baptist churches in the same year. Now, why would Stephen Mumford attend services with the Baptist? Well, there are several reasons one could conjecture. If you look at the statement of beliefs of the Baptist Church in the 1600s, you will find something rather remarkable. They did not accept the Holy Spirit as a person. They were not Trinitarian at that time, at least not these Baptist churches. They believed in the return of Christ to this earth instead of going to heaven. They also had a belief regarding foot washing and what they obviously they call the Lord's Supper for the Passover. So there were some compatible things to the Church of God. The Baptists of the 1600s are not the Baptists of today, or even the Baptists of the 1700s. But Stephen Mumford chose to attend services with the Baptists. But he is not found anywhere on any membership record of this particular church. But it is noted in his own documents, or documents written about him during that period of time, that he did attend with the Baptists. So what it appears that he would do is keep the Sabbath at home with his family, since there were no other Sabbath keepers, he and his wife, Anne would attend for, obviously, fellowship reasons, if no other, the Baptist church. He did not choose the Quaker. Remember, he had two choices for churches, at least a formal church, Baptist or Quaker. And those were the choices that he had at that particular time. So we know that, again, in this particular church, this is the Baptist church of that day, of today, that was the Sabbath 1638, was only about two blocks from his house as well. Everything's in a very small area. This is also only about two or three blocks from where we saw the White Horse Tavern. Now, one of the challenges of the project that I was asked to do was to locate the home of Stephen Mumford, if I could. Well, I looked around, I did all the research I could, went to Mrs. Bullhouse and sat in her office, and I told her what I was looking for. And she said, I remember an old file about the Mumfords hidden back in the vault. If you'll go with me back there, we'll see if we can find it. So sure enough, we went back and open all these files, and there was a folder marked Stephen Mumford's Will. Stephen Mumford's Will. Because I thought if I could find his will, it would identify where his home was located. So we found Stephen Mumford's will. Unfortunately, it was Stephen Mumford the son's will, which was so common at that time, they would name their children. Stephen and Ann Mumford had children named Stephen and Ann Mumford. And so you see that repeated over and over again. So you had to be careful. But it was his son's will. But his son had a home that he willed to his children. And the thought was, well, maybe this is the same home. But it didn't identify an address. It said the house was located so many rods from the harbor going in a particular direction. Well, I thought, I can do this. So I went down to the harbor where the marker was. It was in the will. And I walked off what I felt would be the distance. And I came to this particular house that is actually a museum in Rhode Island today, in Newport. It's called the Wanton Lyman Hazard House. And based on Stephen Mumford, the son's will, I believe this was the home of Stephen Mumford. It was built in the latter part of the 1600s. It is a museum today. So I went to this home thinking that, I can find some information. All the information published in the 1980s declared this to be the Wanton Lyman Hazard home. Now, Wantons were the first owners, then Lyman, and then Hazard. These were the three owners of the house. No mention of Stephen Mumford. While I was walking around the museum on my visit, I found someone writing notes and looking around and making all kinds of notes, and I went over and began talking to him. It turned out he was a graduate student from Brown University, and he was doing a thesis. He was actually working on his doctorate and on this the Wanton Lyman Hazard House. And I told him my theory. I said, I believe this house actually was built by Stephen Mumford. And he looked at me shocked. He said, that's the same conclusion I've come to. And he said, I'm writing it up now for my thesis, and I'm going to present it to those who are the administrators of this house, because I believe this is an important part of the history of this home. And he'd done some dating of the beams and other things there, and it determined it was built by Stephen Mumford. Well, after his thesis was written, a few years later, they now publish in this museum a little booklet that says this house was built by Stephen Mumford. By the research done by the college student, they were convicted that that was true, and that Stephen Mumford was the builder of this home. And today it's reflected on their literature that they publish in the museum. This is the statement in the literature today. The oldest surviving house in Newport, the Wanton Lyman Hazard House, was built for Stephen Mumford in the 1670s. Mumford was a merchant and a founding member of Newport's Seventh-day Baptist congregation. This, it now appears in their official literature. When I was there in 1981, it did not. And again, this student that I happened to come across was the one who wrote it up and submitted it and convinced them that Stephen Mumford was the owner of this home. Here's more from there. This is quoted from the literature of the Wanton Lyman Hazard House today. The house passed to Mumford's son, Stephen Mumford, Jr., and this is where it was listed in the will. The location was given, but again, it was from various markers around the harbor, and again, by kind of walking it off and figuring it out, I had arrived at the same conclusion that this was the home. The house passed to Mumford's son, Stephen Mumford, Jr., and then was sold to Richard Ward, a lawyer who became governor of the colony of Rhode Island in 1741. During the Revolution, Ward's son, Samuel, also was elected to that office. So the Wanton Lyman Hazard House was the home of Stephen Mumford. It is for that day, would have been a very nice home. Stephen Mumford was not a pauper. He was a merchant who imported goods and sold into England. And he was a fairly wealthy man. And, of course, this is also no doubt the location, obviously, where he and his family observed the Sabbath, and probably others later on. Here's a picture of the Wanton Lyman Hazard House today. Now, and again, as I said, it's a museum, and you pay a small fee to get in and walk around the museum. Now, if you recall, another thing on the list that they wanted me to find was Stephen Mumford's grave. Well, I became convinced as well that Stephen Mumford is buried in the backyard of this house. But they won't let you in the backyard. But I could not contain myself from checking out the backyard of this house, because in many of the colonial homes, they would bury the individuals in the backyard. But how do I do this? It's got a big fence in the back here. The backyard is hidden behind here. And you have to go in this way. Well, this is a side street. This is the main street going into Newport. This is a side street. So I decided I'm going to slip along this side street, and I'm going over this fence. It's about 5.5, 6 feet tall. And I'm going over this fence because I have to know. And they're not going to let me go in if I go through the front door. So I wait till there are no cars coming, and I'm over the fence in the back, in the backyard. But there's no grave. And I'm out of there as quickly as I can get out of there. But there was no grave, and I was very disappointed. Now, how do I find Stephen Mumford's grave? But this is the home of Stephen Mumford. This is another picture of it. They've been doing some remodeling. This sign is about some work they're doing on it to upgrade it. But again, this is a fairly recent picture that I actually took a couple of years ago again. But it's right in the center of Newport. Now, how do I find where Stephen Mumford is buried? Well, I discovered that the oldest cemetery in Newport is the Colonial Cemetery, located just down the street. It's located on Farewell Street, which is a good name for you to put a cemetery. Farewell Street, just down from the White Horse Tavern. So I decided, well, I would go to the old Colonial Cemetery and see if I could find where Stephen Mumford was buried. I found his house, which was no one had identified that as his home before. And I'm confident, but he wasn't buried in the backyard, but I'm confident I can find his grave. So I go to the Colonial Cemetery, the oldest, actually I think it's the second oldest cemetery in America, is this cemetery. And I walk into the cemetery. Now I'm going to find his grave. So I walk to the middle of the cemetery. It's 7 acres, several acres in size. And I look in one direction, this is what I see. Well, that's a little intimidating. I look in the next direction, this is what I see. Well, I look in the next direction, this is what I see. And then I look again, and this is what I see. And then I look one more time, and that's what I see. Now, but I'm determined to find it. So I decided I would start walking along the fence line and walk up and down every row of the cemetery until I found where he was buried. And I started walking. I walked for 2 solid days. I would go down. I have my suit on, and I'm walking up and down this cemetery day after day, people honking as they go by. And there's some famous carvings in this cemetery. There's the one-armed lady carving. There's a statue on one of the headstones. For people who study gravestones, this is a real treasure trove here. The one-armed lady is here. It's famous. I found out there's actually a magazine for people who like to look at headstones. magazine just for headstone lookers. And in this magazine, they have this one-arm lady. And so this lady evidently had one arm, and so they put a statue of her on the headstone with one arm. You know, to, obviously because she only had one arm. So that's a famous headstone. There are other famous headstones in here as well. But I was having no success. After 2 days, the third day, I was about ready to give up. So I went to the Newport Historical Society and sat down in Mrs. Bullhouse's little reception area office. And she says, "What's wrong? You look discouraged." And I said, "Well, I can't find what I'm looking for." Now, she had helped me already find Stephen Mumford's will. And I said, "I'm looking for his grave now." She said, "Well, you know," she said, I remember an old plat map that's way in the back of the vault where we keep stuff. It's, you know, it's got to be 200 years old or older." And she said, "If you'll come back and help me, we'll get a ladder and we'll get that old plat map out." And sure enough, we go back in the very back of this big old vault. Here's this old vellum paper, a leather paper type of a document that you roll open, and here it is. It's a plat map of the entire cemetery, giving every location of every where everyone is buried. And sure enough, right here is where Stephen Mumford's family's tomb or family plot is located. And I found it on this plat map, so now I knew where it was. And based on the plat map, I could follow from the roads and I could find my way up to the grave. And after this, looking at this map, I went right to his grave. And here is the headstone for Stephen Mumford. This is his family. This is Stephen. You're going to find his children and his wife Anne next to him as well. This is the Mumford grave site. Here's what it says on the headstone of Stephen Mumford. "Here lieth buried ye body of Stephen Mumford, aged 68 years, and departed this life July 1707. Now, I was a bit disturbed when I found it because, of course, there's been some damage done to the headstone. But you'll see that the headstone had a pagan symbol on it. It had a skull with wings coming out of it on the top. And I thought, well, that didn't make sense for someone who was a Sabbath keeper. They were opposed to any pagan symbols. They had no steeples. They had no crosses. So how did this come about? Well, it dawned on me that none of their children followed in the keeping the Sabbath, and obviously they're the ones who buried him. And also, when I looked at, I became experienced in identifying the age of tombstone as to the way they're shaped, as to what year they would have been put there. During this period of time in my studies, I could identify the dates of headstones from a distance just based on the shape of the headstone. This headstone would have been probably mid-1700s because of the shape of it and also the width of it. The headstones from the 1600s are going to be shorter and they're going to be a bit thinner than this. So this headstone was placed well after he died by his descendants, therefore explaining the pagan symbols that were put on the headstone. But Stephen Mumford would not have accepted those as a part of his religious practice. And here's his wife, Anne. "Here lieth buried ye body of Anne Mumford, ye wife of Stephen Mumford, age 63 years, deceased February the 22nd. Notice this, 1697/8. What does that mean? They didn't know what year she died in? Now you get into a bit of a calendar issue. The British colonies did not accept the Gregorian calendar until 1752. Prior to that, every other part of the world except that part ruled by the British had already adopted the Gregorian calendar. The Gregorian calendar, the Julian calendar began the year in March. The Gregorian calendar started the year in January. So all dates between January and March are suspect as to what year they belong depending on the calendar. This also was further evidence to me that this headstone was placed here after 1752. Else there had been no need for this 97/8. Because in 1697, February would have been in 1697, but in 1752, February now becomes 1698. That's why many, many dates, in fact all dates, prior to 1752 in colonial America are suspect as to their dating because of the two different calendars, Julian versus Gregorian calendar. This was further evidence to me that the pagan symbols exist on these headstones because the headstones were put here after 1752. At least this one was 1752. In addition to discovering the headstone of the Mumfords, there were seven members to the original Sabbath-keeping church. One of them was a bachelor by the name of Roger Bastard. Some actually claim his name was Roger the Bastard because there was some question about his legitimacy at birth. But he's officially listed as Roger Bastard. This is also listed in the Journal for Headstones, one of the most unique headstones and oldest headstones in colonial America. He did his own headstone. So compare this one to the one that I showed you about the Mumfords, and notice there are no symbols. It is a very plain stone that has carved in the stone what he wanted to say about himself. He designed his own headstone, and he asked them to carve what he wanted on there as opposed to what they may have carved. Here's what he had carved on his headstone. Again, he's one of the original members. "Here lieth ye body of Roger Bastard, bachelor blockmaker, first bachelor in the church, died as a bachelor, though, unfortunately. Age 66 years, died 23rd day of April, 1687. He was one of the first beginners of a Church of Christ observing of the Seventh-day Sabbath of the Lord in New England." These people were so felt so highly of the fact that they kept the Sabbath that they wanted everyone to know, and you'll find on many of their headstones they mention that they were Sabbath keepers, this being one of them. So Roger Bastard was one of the original seven members of the first Sabbath-keeping church in America, joining with the Mumfords and other families that formed the very first Sabbath-keeping church. Now, where is the church building itself, dating back to this period of time? This is the Newport Historical Society in downtown Newport. This society has connected to the back of it a separate building, oddly. This building has been attached here. It's all made of brick now. This was the Sabbatarian Meeting House, the oldest Sabbatarian Meeting House in the United States of America. This one actually dates to 1727. This was after Stephen Mumford. But after the church outgrew the home of the Mumfords, they actually had a church hall built, and this was it. And it's still there today. It's a museum connected to the Newport Historical Society. The Seventh-day Baptists own this building today. They've donated it to the city of Newport, and they've made a museum out of it. And you can go in and visit it to this very day. But notice it's very plain. There are no steeples. There are no crosses. None of that was on this building. It was a very plain, square building. All of their buildings were similar during this period of time. This is another picture of it, the building connected to it. This is the interior. They would put the podium would be raised. You know, the floor is down here. They have a stair for the pastor to walk up and stand behind this very ornately carved podium. And they always had the Ten Commandments behind the podium in all of their buildings. There's also something else unique here. The main door, the front door, is always behind the podium. And the reason for that is that you did not dare come to church late. If you did, you had to walk by the pastor, and he called your name out as you walked into church. And this is consistent with all of their church buildings, where to get into the main hall, you have to walk right by the lectern. And there are several church records where they called people out for being late. And I'll have more to say as we go along. Here's a plaque inside this building that identifies the original seven members. Now, you have to understand what's happening here among this group. There actually were 11 people who began keeping the Sabbath at Stephen Mumford's home. But in 1670, four of them rejected the Sabbath and went back to only keeping Sunday. Four of them rejected the Sabbath, leaving seven. Now there's a problem. When they were meeting on the Sabbath in Stephen Mumford's home and then going to the Baptist church on Sunday, everything worked okay. But when four of them rejected the Sabbath and went back to Sunday, the other seven felt they could no longer go to the Baptist church and fellowship with heretics. In other words, if someone had never known the truth, they were okay. But someone who knew the truth and rejected it, they could no longer fellowship with them. There is a whole series of letters written back to England by Stephen Mumford on what should they do. And one of his tenants wrote back and said, you can no longer fellowship with people who have rejected God's truth. So the Mumfords stopped attending, but the Mumfords were never members. But the others, Samuel Hubbard, his wife Tacy, Roger Baster, and Rachel Langworthy, and William Hiscox, all felt they could no longer attend. But they continued attending for a while. Then on one Sunday, it is recorded that the associate pastor, a man by the name of Obadiah Holmes, gave a sermon. Now, you might say, well, where do we get all this information? All of this is recorded in very detailed minutes and records of what was said during this period of time. So Obadiah Holmes gave a sermon, and he said, some of you have gone back to Moses. Some of you have gone back to Moses, and you've started keeping Saturday. He said, that is wrong, and he denounced them to the whole congregation. To which Samuel Hubbard stood up and he says, Mr. Holmes, are you talking about us? And Obadiah Holmes is quoted as saying, if the shoe fits, wear it. And then the minutes say there was a tumult in the hall. And they finally got order established, and they agreed to wait until John Clark returned from a trip, and they would have a meeting at the church hall the next Thursday, and demanded that all of those who were keeping the Sabbath show up. And actually there would be five of them, because Stephen and Ann Mumford were no longer there. Five of them showed up at the church hall: Obadiah Holmes, John Clark, and one other associate pastor were there to talk to them. It's recorded that John Clark asked the question, is it true that you have been keeping Saturday for the Sabbath and believe that that is something that's necessary? No one spoke, according to the minutes. Finally, after a long pause, Tacy Hubbard spoke up, and she said, yes, sir, because the scriptures tell us to do that. To which John Clark declared they were heretics and they should no longer come to the Baptist church. It was after that that the first Sabbath-keeping church was formed with these seven people. It was December 23rd, 1671, according to the Julian calendar. It was an interesting group of seven people that formed that first Sabbath-keeping church. William Hiscox's wife was never a part of the church, so you have an individual whose mate was not a part of the church. Stephen Mumford and his wife Ann, obviously a couple who were a part of the church, a man and his wife. Roger Baster was a single who was a part of this group. And Rachel Langworthy was a young adult who had married Richard Langworthy, who never became a part of the church. And she traveled all the way from Westerly, which was a distance of about 50 miles to come to services, the western part of Rhode Island. These were the original seven members. Now, how do we know all of this about them? Well, another discovery that we made at this time were the old records of the church. These are the minutes that were kept by the church from 1692. This book is from 1692 all the way to into the 1700s. Minute details of all the things that went on in this local church. The reason there are no records prior to 1692 is that in 1692 there was a fire that burned all of the records. So this book is the oldest. It begins in 1692. This also was discovered by Mrs. Bullhouse, and she allowed me full access to it. You cannot get access to any of this material today. This book is old. Obviously, 1692 is falling apart, but it was stored away. No one even knew. I shouldn't say no one knew. It wasn't put out in a museum or anything, but it was just laying in the back of the vault when we discovered it. These are the minutes of all their meetings and all the things that went on. This is the inside cover of the church minutes, 1692. This is the list of members. This is from 1707. On the left is a rewritten copy because it's hard to read this particular copy. But Rachel Langworthy is still here. She's still a part of the church. She was one of the only original members that's still here. I want you to also notice that they put all the men on the left and all the women on the right. Were members of the church in 1707. The faithfulness of the women as a part of the church at this time is quite extraordinary. In addition to Rachel Langworthy, I always found it interesting some of the names. This is a lady named Free Love Barker. Who would name their daughter Free Love Barker? So anyway, that was her name. There were two twins that were a part of, not a part of the church, but a part of that community. One was called Resolve to Do Good, and the other one was called Wrestling the Devil. So they were Wrestling and Resolve were two twin boys that were at that time. So some of the names are a bit unusual. But Rachel Langworthy is still there. Women are the primary members of the church in 1707. Here's another section of the minutes about an ordination that took place in 1715. All the details about the ordination. The church believed very strongly in church discipline. They had what they call letters of admonition. You were expected to be at church every Sabbath, no matter what. And if you missed three Sabbaths in a row, after the third Sabbath on Sunday, all the elders of the church would show up at your home. And you had to tell them why you were not there. If you didn't give a good reason, you received a letter of admonition from the church. There was a lady that lived on Martha's Vineyard. Now, Martha's Vineyard is an island off the coast of Rhode Island. She had to take a ferry boat for several hours. Then she'd have to take a carriage to get up to Newport in order to be at church. But she was expected to be there. And she didn't show up for about 3 weeks in a row. And she received a letter of admonition. This is the letter of admonition written to Abigail Barker. And it was written in, I think this is 1715. Abigail Barker is evidently the mother of Free Love Barker, and you may see why she named her daughter Free Love. This is to Abigail Barker. It's written by the church, again, in 1730. 1729, last 30. March 15, 1729, 1730. Here's what it said. To Abigail Barker from our church meeting March 15th. Whereas you were laid under admonition for your evil course of life in keeping bad company and drinking to excess and neglecting to attend God's public worship. She was reprimanded. If you got two letters of admonition, you were put out of the church after the second letter of admonition. So here is Abigail Barker, who evidently wasn't not all that circumspect in her lifestyle. It also shows that, of course, they had no problem in drinking alcohol. It was just not to excess. But Abigail Barker's main problem was she did not come to church every Sabbath and therefore was reprimanded. And her daughter was named Free Love Barker. So anyway, I'm not sure where all this connects. Her evil company may have been a part of that. Who knows? But this is the minutes are filled with letters written to individual members, and it's a very interesting book to read. I could not photocopy these books, but I took photos of each page of the book. So I have copies, as you'll see here, that I've turned into slides for their minutes. And again, you cannot get access to these today. One of the more famous members of the Sabbath-keeping church was a man by the name of Samuel Ward. Samuel Ward was would have been a signer of the Declaration of Independence. He was a governor of Rhode Island, of the colony of Rhode Island, he and his father. And on his father's grave, it says on his mother's grave, it says she was a Sabbath keeper for 55 years. What people don't realize is that the dominant religion in the Newport area, in the southern part of Rhode Island, were the Sabbath keepers. At one time, the largest church in America was the Sabbath Keepers. They had over 2,500 members. 2,500 members. They were dominant in that part of Rhode Island. And it's not all that difficult to understand why the Wards were members. And this is where the connection with Benjamin Franklin. Samuel Ward was a good friend of Benjamin Franklin. He spent many weeks at Samuel Ward's home in Newport. Richard and Samuel Ward, these are their graves. They were both governors of Rhode Island. This is Samuel Ward. He was a Sabbath keeper in colonial Rhode Island. He also served as governor. Now, the interesting thing about this is that Samuel Ward is never listed as a member of the church. In their baptismal records, they never listed him as a member of the church. And his father was not listed as a member until just before he died. He was baptized. Now, I don't know, I can't absolutely prove this, but I know that they were conscientious objectors. And they also did not believe in getting involved in politics. It is my opinion that they refused to baptize Samuel Ward because of his political career. He attended services, he kept the Sabbath, but was not baptized by this church. Again, that's just my supposition. I don't have complete proof of that. This is a document that was signed in Philadelphia in 1775. It's called the Document of Secrecy. This preceded the Declaration of Independence, in which they all agreed to keep secret their work. You see John Hancock's signature and all of those who signed it. You'll also see here the signature of Samuel Ward. He would have been a signer of the Declaration of Independence. This is his signature, a unique style, where it was Sam: Ward is the way he signed his name. And he died of smallpox. There was a smallpox epidemic that swept through Philadelphia in the spring of 1776, and he died of smallpox before the Declaration of Independence was signed, or else he would have been a signer of the Declaration. There were Sabbath keepers spread from Newport over to western Rhode Island. This is where Rachel Langworthy was from. They became quite dominant in western Rhode Island in the area of Westerly. This whole area was dominated by Sabbath keepers. To this day, the local newspaper in Westerly, Rhode Island, does not publish on Saturday. It's owned by the Utter family, and they have a long history of being Sabbath keepers. So the newspaper does not publish on Saturday in Westerly, Rhode Island, because of the dominance of the Sabbath keepers. This is a plaque that talks about 3,000 people being baptized in the Pawcatuck River over a period of years. This is where the Sabbath keepers baptized their members in western Rhode Island in the Pawcatuck River. Again, you'll see that in the river pool where they were baptized. This is the current Seventh-day Baptist church building. It dates back to the early 1800s. The steeple was added, I think, in 1838. In the early 1800s, they adopted the name Seventh-day Baptist, and they became truly Baptist by religion, but they happened to keep the Sabbath. And today, the Seventh-day Baptists are a Baptist group that happens to keep the Sabbath. But they preserved much of the history. Again, this is their current meeting house. 1835. See the dates on this. This is a plaque out front telling the history of the Sabbath keepers. Seventh-day Baptist members first worshiped in this community in 1674. That was Rachel. This is where Rachel Langworthy lived, and pretty soon a church was built in this part of Rhode Island as well. The Sabbath keepers are so dominant in this area that there are many names in the area that reflect the Sabbath keepers. This is a bridge that's called Boom Bridge. Well, the bridge, the road goes across this bridge. It's called Boom Bridge Road. It got its name from the Sabbath keepers. During the time when the Sabbath was being kept by members in Rhode Island, you still could not keep the Sabbath in Connecticut. So Sabbath keepers from Connecticut had to cross the Pawcatuck River to come to church in Westerly. In order to do that, they either had to walk several miles up to the only bridge to cross, or one of the inventive members felled a tree, put the tree like a fulcrum over the stump, tied it down, and would put people on one end and swing them across. And that's where the term Boom Bridge came from. It's recorded in the church minutes that often people came to church soaking wet because they fell off Boom Bridge. But they still came because if you didn't come, you would have a visit. So this is Boom Bridge to this day. Virtually all, and this is a picture of Boom Bridge today, where the bridge is. It's hard to imagine how you would add a tree big enough to swing all the way across, but that's what is recorded that they did at that time. It's also interesting that on one side, this is the Pawcatuck River. Over here is Connecticut. Over here is Rhode Island. This, all of the, on the Rhode Island side, all of the property refers to the Sabbath path in their property definitions. Because once you crossed the bridge, you had to walk along the river to get to church, and it was called the Sabbath path. And it's still in the deeds of all the properties along the Pawcatuck River refer to the Sabbath path as a part of their boundaries. This is the cemetery where the pastors are buried of the Seventh-day Baptists going all the way back to 1680. They've left a couple of openings here because they're still existing today. These are all their pastors. This is the location of their first meeting house, the one that was moved later on into the city. This is where it is. This cemetery is dominated by Sabbath keepers, and many, many of the headstones have a reference to the resurrection and to the Sabbath on their headstones. Minister's Monument. One other interesting fact about the early colonial period is this is Brown University, one of the most well-known Ivy League schools in the United States. Brown University was founded by Sabbath keepers. There were five individuals who formed the first board of Brown University. It was first called Rhode Island College, but later on a man by the name of Nicholas Brown donated several acres of land in the city of Providence, and the college was renamed Brown University. Brown University was founded by five men. Three were Sabbath keepers, two were Sunday keepers, who wanted to maintain religion and ethics in America. So it was established for religious and ethical reasons. Brown University has the largest collection of Americana, American history, in the United States, and it's all on microfiche, and you can have access to a good bit of that. A lot of the books that we used in our research were found in the John Hay Library. In the basement of the John Hay Library, I found the diary of Samuel Hubbard that we were also told it does not exist. I mean, this is literally occurred. Mr. Blackwell, Mr. Dean Blackwell, wanted to do some of the research as well. We were in the basement of Brown. I'm sorry. This is Hay Library. We were in the basement of the Rockefeller Library, which is another library. And we were in the basement, and when you go in the basement, you have to turn a switch, and the light will stay on for so many minutes, and it goes off. So we turn the switch on, we're looking around, trying to find what we're looking for, you know, books about the Sabbatarians, and it goes off. We have to run back, turn the light back on. Well, once the light went off, and Mr. Blackwell went and turned it back on, and I'm standing against a pile of books, and I have my hand leaning when it goes dark, and I pull the book out, and it's Samuel Hubbard's journal. Now, Samuel Hubbard is one of the original Sabbath keepers. He and his wife, Tacy Hubbard. I had read about his journal, his diary. But every place I read, they said it was destroyed in the fire that occurred in the 1690s. But there it was. It was actually a typed copy, a manuscript of his journal, where he told about being converted to believe in the Sabbath, keeping the Sabbath, and teaching his children. And he also had a letter from Roger Williams about the holy days. And so this was a document we also discovered that we'd been told no longer existed. And again, we were able to make copies of it, and I have copies of it today. So those are some of the unusual things that happened in the journey to collect information. But again, a lot of other books were found in the John Hay Library about the Sabbath keepers. There's quite a bit of information. This is the Rhode Island State House. It is all marble, the only state house of any of the states that's all marble. On the top, there is a statue of it's like a Greek soldier. He's standing like this with a spear, and underneath it says, "Free Man." And the motto, or at least not the motto, but the saying underneath it in Rhode Island is that we will never again be under anyone's domination or something to that effect. And, of course, Rhode Island was the place of freedom of religion, truly, among all the colonies. It brings us full circle all the way back to Matthew 16, verse 18, where Christ said, "I will build my church, and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it." Our challenge is to find the people of God down through the years. There is no doubt they've existed. What I've shown you today, I do not profess that every single individual could be identified as a part of the true church. I believe that the true church followed this thread from southern France to England to Rhode Island, across to the Midwest, across to the Northwest. You have the Church of God Seventh Day, and you have Mr. Armstrong's contact in Oregon, and of course leading to where we are today. I believe there's a consistent thread. I would not go so far as to try to identify every single person. The church has survived during all these years. Every time an area closed, God opened up another area, and the church has been preserved. So that's the story. I hope you found it interesting. I hope you found it helpful. I thought I would go straight through so that now gives you about 25 minutes or so until Dr. Levy will be here. And if he's awake by now, we may have to give him a wake-up call and get him here to do his next presentation. So thanks for your attention. And again, I hope it was profitable for you.